This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiswu Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the UN Children's Fund reports a fourfold increase over all of last year in the number of children, especially girls, being used as so-called human bombs by Boko Haram militants in northeast Nigeria.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next.
Also, an armed group made up of hundreds of civilians, police, and military is stopping migrant boats from leaving Libya. And about 60 bodies have washed ashore in Freetown, Sierra Leone, more than a week after a mudslide killed more than 500 people.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the UN Children's Fund reports an alarming increase in the use of so-called human bombs by Boko Haram insurgents in northeast Nigeria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund reports a fourfold increase over all of last year in the number of children, especially girls, being used as so-called human bombs by Boko Haram militants in northeast Nigeria. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says 83 children were forced to go on suicide missions. She says 55 of the children were girls under the age of 15, 27 were boys, and one was an infant strapped to a girl. She says the consequences for all children are terrible. Because of their role as human bombs, she tells VOA, children are widely viewed with suspicion.
There's an extraordinary level of tension, obviously, in these communities. And people are afraid of children who have been victimized in this absolutely appalling way. There are instances of children being ostracized by their communities, and worse. So yes, like, terrible things are happening to children after already horrific things have happened to them.
UNICEF calls the use of children as human bombs an atrocity and says they are above all victims and not perpetrators. It says rejecting children who have been released by Boko Haram or have escaped simply compounds their suffering. The agency notes most of the attacks are on so-called soft targets, such as markets, schools, universities, and displacement camps, and most take place in Borno State. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There's been a dramatic and unexpected slowdown in the flow of migrants from Libya to Europe, and we may know why. Reuters is reporting that an armed group made up of hundreds of civilians, police and military is stopping boats from leaving Libya. Reuters quotes sources in the city of Sabratha, about 70 kilometers west of Tripoli. They say the new group is preventing migrants from leaving and even detaining them. The sources say the group is seeking funding from Tripoli to make it appear legitimate. The International Organization for Migration says more than 120,000 migrants have crossed the Mediterranean to Europe so far this year. More than 2,400 have died trying to do so. The IOM also reports there's been a crackdown on North African and Bangladeshi migrants from Tripoli's Mitiga airport. That's after groups supporting the government of National Accord forced out a militia that controlled the migrant trade.
Angolans are preparing for a historic election tomorrow as their longtime leader steps down after nearly four decades in power. However, before the polls open, opposition parties are raising suspicions that the vote might not be fair. From the capital, Luanda, VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Excitement, but also suspicion, swirls around Angola's capital as the nation readies itself for the vote, the first that many citizens will have seen without the longtime president on the ballot. José Eduardo dos Santos is stepping down after 38 years in power. Five parties are challenging his powerful People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, which has ruled since independence in 1975 and is widely expected to win again. Already, the two main opposition parties, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, or UNITA, and Broad Convergence for the Salvation of Angola Electoral Coalition, or CASACE, say they have noted irregularities in the election preparations. They have accused the ruling party of using government vehicles and resources for campaigning, and allege the state broadcaster has given preferential treatment to the ruling party. The MPLA has denied irregularities. Youth-oriented CASACE said this week cast further doubt over the integrity of the poll by announcing it would make an independent vote tally of Wednesday's poll results. Party candidate and spokesman Lindu Bernardo Titu says his party fears the MPLA will rig this poll to bring in its candidate, Defense Minister João Lourenço.
O Partido Estado que se instalou neste país...
The ruling party installed in this country does not guarantee fair, free, and transparent elections, he told VOA. The Electoral Commission has dismissed the allegations and maintained that the vote will be free and fair. Final rallies for the main parties drew tens of thousands of boisterous supporters in the capital this week. At the MPLA rally, Lourenço led voters in cheering for a party victory and praising Dos Santos, who he described as an architect of peace, for his leadership during Angola's 27-year civil war that ended in 2002. Analysts and voters say the election is an important opportunity for this oil-rich nation. It could, says Professor Ryuk Andove of the Independent University of Angola, signal a new era in post-war politics. It's important, he said, because it's the first time that Angolans are going to an election with the main actors from the Civil War era outside of the electoral game. Some voters are undeterred by the controversy and say they are eager to make their mark. Ruling party supporter Daniel Kailane, I'm going to vote for the first time, the 21-year-old told VOA, saying he is excited to give the contribution to the country. And 80-year-old voter Domingos Nicolau spoke of the hope he had when Angola gained independence from Portugal, and how he is disappointed that the nation's immense oil wealth hasn't trickled down to him or his 12 grandchildren, or for that matter, the majority of citizens. That's why, after previously supporting the ruling party, he's changing sides.
Nós queremos uma mudança livre.
We want to make a free and a fair change, he told VOA. That is a common refrain on the hectic streets of the seaside capital, where luxury cars and banged-up buses weave through potholed streets, and where oil rigs twinkle off the coast at night, lending the only light to coastal neighborhoods that have never had electricity, and where one man watches from his pink palace atop Luanda's highest hill and prepares, after so many years, to step down. Anita Powell, VOA News, Luanda, Angola.
In Freetown, Sierra Leone, about 60 bodies have washed ashore more than a week after a mudslide killed more than 500 people. AFP says Yassine Carbo, the head of the city's tourism office, is warning people not to swim in the area due to floating debris, mud, and contamination. He says one survivor was actually found among the victims that came ashore. Heavy rains washed away part of Mount Sugarloaf on August 14th, sweeping away people sleeping in their homes. About 600 people are still reported missing.
The Southern African Development Community, SADC, is calling on the DRC Electoral Commission to release a new date for a presidential election. At its just-ended summit in Johannesburg, leaders passed a resolution for the commission to publish a new election calendar. Presidential elections in the DRC were supposed to be held in December. However, no preparations have been made and funding is lacking. There have been many violent and deadly protests as a result. SADC also has approved the appointment of a special envoy to the DRC that is expected to be a former head of state. South African president is the new chair of SADC. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehia Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Violence has subsided in rural central Kenya as a result of rainfall, national security operations, and elections that ousted some politicians blamed for inciting pastoralists to bring their livestock onto private lands. However, the northern rangelands, home of pastoralists, remain overgrazed and need proper management to keep problems at bay. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Violence surged in central Kenya earlier this year as armed northern herders brought thousands of cattle, sheep, and goats onto private property, prompting clashes that took the lives of both humans and wildlife. It didn't help that some politicians encouraged constituents to graze their livestock wherever they could find grass and water. Peter Hetz, executive director of the Laikipia Wildlife Forum, says that although the recent elections removed some of those politicians, there are still unresolved issues.
The fact remains is that there are still people with guns and there are still livestock that don't belong here roaming this territory, and the government still must resolve to do something about that.
According to Kenyan Ministry of Interior spokesman Mwenden Njoka, security operations in the central parts of the country are still ongoing.
I could give assurance to both the locals and the foreigners who are in that area that at least security has returned to significantly normalized.
Josh Parrott, the manager for Laikipia's Mugi Ranch, agrees that things have improved since earlier this year. The grass has returned, the wildlife look better, and poaching has dropped significantly, he says. But Parrott says illegal grazing continues, citing several occasions since the end of July when his team caught herds of roughly 400 cattle at a time on the ranch.
Every day we have issues with cows coming in somewhere. It's just not to the scale or to the aggression that it was in January.
The relative gains experienced in central Kenya have not reached the northern semi-arid rangelands, home of many of the pastoralists, according to Frank Pope, CEO of Save the Elephants. He says that after many decades of sustained overgrazing, the topsoil has now disappeared from many of the areas. And as a result, there is nowhere for the large numbers of goats and cattle to graze.
There's been no good rain in the north. There have been some patches of rain, but really there's no let up for the situation in the north. And we'll wait to see what the new government decides to do and whether they decide they can grasp this nettle of how to control grazing amongst the pastoralists. But if they don't, I think the north will continue its march towards full desert conditions.
Experts have encouraged the government to implement long-term rangeland management practices in the north and to explore options of tagging livestock in order to keep track of who owns which animals. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is apparently being forced to work at home after spending more than 100 days on medical leave in London. According to AFP, while Buhari was away, rodents damaged his office. They chewed and soiled furniture and damaged air conditioning fittings. The president's media advisor downplayed the rodent rampage, saying what is important is that the job gets done, whether he does it from his bedroom or his sitting room. No word on what type of rodent was responsible for damaging Buhari's office, but rat problems are common.
The Pew Research Center estimates that there are nearly 3.5 million Muslims in the U.S. and over 1.5 billion worldwide. Yet, until recently, Muslim communities and characters were hard to find in mainstream popular books for children, teens, and young adults. That's a situation the publishing label Salam Reads seeks to remedy. Part of the New York-based publishing giant Simon & Schuster, Salam Reads, goal is to publish stories that reflect Muslim experiences in all their diversity. Zarin Jafri is the Pakistan-American executive editor of Simon & Schuster, Books for Young Readers. She explained to VOA's Adam Phillips why it was important to start a publishing label focused on Muslim-themed books for young readers.
The reason for that is complex. I wanted to reach out to communities that were underrepresented in popular culture, underrepresented in children's literature. And one of those communities was the Muslim community, which is a community that I am from. I'm born in the US. My parents are from Pakistan, and we are Muslim. And we really never saw ourselves in literature accurately depicted. And I knew that this was an experience that many kids were having. So I knew that there was a place for this and a need for this. I have been a children's book editor for a number of years. And once I finally got to a position high enough that I could acquire not only the books that were anticipated to be bestsellers, but I could acquire books that had personal meaning to me and be able to pull in a lot of underrepresented, misrepresented, demonized communities and show the truth of their experience.
By this, I know you mean Muslim communities, Muslim experiences. Is there something you want the general reader in America and abroad to understand about the Muslim world overall?
Just that the diversity within the Muslim community is enormous. We come from a variety of different backgrounds. We speak a variety of different languages. We may share the same religious holidays, but we celebrate them differently. And that is something that is so misunderstood.
Give me an example of a character in a book that you published that really touched you.
The first book we published is Amna's Voice by Hena Khan. It's a middle grade story about a girl who is going into middle school and sort of the identity conflicts that she faces, having to come to terms with what it means to be an American kid, as opposed to a Pakistani American Muslim kid. So there is that tension in that hyphenated identity that she has never really felt before. And what does that mean? It's a lovely story and it ends on a very happy note, which I think is important when you're publishing books for kids. You have to leave them with a sense of hope.
What's another book?
The book we most recently published is called Saints and Misfits, and it's a young adult novel about a young girl who is dealing with a very complicated emotional issue where she was nearly sexually assaulted by someone in the Muslim community. And she is a devout Muslim herself. And the journey that she goes on is one of understanding that you cannot tell how devout a person is just by looking at them, and you cannot tell if someone is good or bad just by looking at them. And in this case, with this person, she realizes that he may project himself as someone who is pious, but his actions betray him.
Have you gotten any feedback from readers?
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of feedback from Muslims all over the world already, from adults and children who have read these books and have said, I finally was able to see parts of myself that I have never seen celebrated. And it makes them feel a little bit more confident in the world. And it offers them an opportunity to share a part of themselves with kids that are around them. You know, being able to share a work of art with your peers is an incredible experience, especially when you have never had that opportunity to do so before.
That was Zareen Jafri, executive editor of Simon & Schuster's Books for Young Readers and Salam Reads. She spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Homeschooling is on the rise in South Africa. Parents are choosing this route for various reasons, ranging from religion to a lack of faith in the public education system. While there are no definitive numbers for homeschoolers, some insiders put the figure at close to 400,000. Reporter Nadia Sami in Johannesburg says homeschool study centers are booming.
Many South African parents are shunning traditional schools and opting for homeschooling. Some have no faith in the public schooling system, as the Basic Education Department has lowered the pass requirements several times, meaning more kids are passing but with poorer grades. For example, in South Africa currently, a child can be put into the next grade after scoring just 30% in certain subjects, along with other requirements. Other parents opt for homeschooling for religious reasons or because their children have special needs. And then there are gifted children who find a conventional setting frustrating and they're more comfortable being educated at their own pace at home. Susan Frieser has run To Educate Academics for the past 5 years. It's a study center in Johannesburg providing an enabling environment for teenagers who are homeschooled. She says there are several reasons parents turn to homeschooling.
Mainly because they're unhappy. The kids are unhappy. They're anxious. They're suffering from depression or a variety of other things, or they find they don't fit the mold. They've been bullied. Basically, mainstream doesn't work for everyone.
For many years, there was a stigma attached to homeschooling, but Susan says perceptions have changed quite drastically.
Yeah, homeschoolers used to be considered very, very odd, very often very religious, which, you know, there are certain sectors that still do homeschooling because of their religious affiliations. But I think there are less kids fitting the mold and seeking alternatives. And so cottage schools and study centres and traditional homeschooling have become more and more of an option. Also, with government schools being what they are, many parents feel, I can do a better job at home with my kids in our own timetable. And added to that, the pressures of getting up, getting into uniform, eating on time, sitting in traffic for 10 minutes to an hour to get your child to school, the pressure that places on a family is tremendous.
She believes the basic education department's constant lowering of pass marks will have devastating effects in future.
Firstly, I think on a psychological level, you're telling kids that they don't have to aim high. They don't have to achieve more than the bare minimum, which the bare minimum is getting lower and lower. I've taught at a tertiary level, and I've seen these kids coming through with matric exemptions, having got 30% for English, and they're entering journalism studies, and they can't put a sentence together.
Homeschoolers often have an entirely different approach to the work they're doing, often asking the question, how useful is this to me? For example, if mathematics is not something a student requires for the career choice they've made, the subject will be dealt with in a more relevant manner, focusing perhaps on household budgets, balancing the books, or using various banking products, taking from mathematics what's needed for everyday life. Susan says she's noticed a marked difference in kids who are being homeschooled versus kids in the mainstream.
Their anxiety levels are much lower. They're definitely more relaxed, you know, and they look much like homeschoolers with the long hair, blue hair or whatever. And they've got those freedoms and stuff. But generally, they're nice kids. They're able to talk to people of different ages because a lot of homeschoolers get together and they've got from toddlers to teens and they all hang out.
Susan's study centre follows the International Cambridge System, which is recognised in over 170 countries.
Support-wise, they study through the British International Distance College. They provide the academic material, so it's a 30-week work programme per subject. They do a fair bit of assignments, which they then submit to the college. Then the tutors at the college will mark them, return it. The kids can then see, you know, where they went wrong, where they got right. And online, there's a huge Cambridge community. There's lots of tutorials on YouTube.
The education department stipulates that everyone under the age of 15 must be registered, whether that's at a mainstream or homeschool. But not all homeschooling parents register, as some fear they'll be given a hard time by the government. So while there are no exact figures for homeschoolers in South Africa, estimates range from 50,000 to a whopping 400,000.
This is Nadia Sami for VOA Africa, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Join with leaders like President Sirleaf.
Malaria stops footballers from scoring and students from learning.
And join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
United, we can beat malaria.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali,
host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss why ailing African leaders often travel abroad for their medical care. Should this be an acceptable practice? We'll delve into the issue on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.